A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Good evening and welcome to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Derek Brown, as we settle in for 2 hours of the best possible radio you could listen to know all the things you need to know.
And there's plenty to know, especially today.
That's right.
A lot going on.
Absolutely a lot going on. So, Derek, here's the thing I think is kind of interesting. Yesterday, we had a conversation with the Salt Lake City Chamber president talking about how immigration is a top priority for business leaders. Such low unemployment rates, businesses are looking for people to hire, right? And so that was kind of focusing on how can we get immigration reform that gets more labor into the country.
Which has always been an issue.
I mean,
the years that I worked on the Hill, like everyone, like from both parties said H-1B visas, like the skilled worker, you know, visas. I mean, they have these caps.
Right.
And everyone agreed we got to raise those caps because like the number of people that fit, like they'd start filling up in January and by February it was full. So everyone has been saying, look, we got to do something about this.
Right. And if you're trying to hire, does that make sense? And you're like, I know I have someone who could do this job, but I need the visa to get them here.
Exactly.
Right? So, but it does kind of beg the question, because I think maybe it's not the case that there aren't people, so I'm going to use like a double negative, so just stay with me, that there aren't people in Utah who could not find a job if they didn't want one today. Right. So the answer basically is, low unemployment rates doesn't mean zero unemployment rates. So there must be people who are unemployed who might be trying to find work. And so we thought we'd have a conversation, Derek, about that. Does that make sense? So we kind of talk about this at the real aggregate level. Millions of job openings. We're looking for labor. Does that make sense? But I imagine that's probably not universally true across all job sectors, right? So maybe not universally true for all Utahns looking for work. So I could be wrong, but we thought we'd dig into this a little bit. We've got Mark Nold, chief economist with the Department of Workforce Services, to walk us through what we're talking about. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
So first of all, correct anything I said earlier if I said something wrong, because sometimes I throw numbers out and maybe I'm making them up, maybe I read them somewhere. But can you talk to us about what the unemployment rate looks like in Utah? I feel like nationally we're somewhere around 3%. I don't know if Utah is much better or maybe nationally has got a different number. Tell us what that looks like when we're talking about jobs.
Sure. For both entities, they're both experiencing very low, almost historically low unemployment rates for who they are. Now, that doesn't mean they're the same rates. Here in the state of Utah, we have a different dynamic in our economy. We have a different labor market, a much younger one, and so on. So our unemployment rate is down in the around 2.4%, rock bottom. It rarely, the lowest I think we've ever gone in this state is 2%. United States unemployment rate, it inched up a little bit to 3.8, but it came off a 3.5% unemployment rate recently. That hadn't been seen since before the baby boom generation entered into the labor market. So you're dealing with very, very low unemployment rates, very historically tight labor markets in terms of the economy absorbing labor and asking for it, and there not being this large body of idled available workers out there to fill the gap.
And what is that baseline number beyond which, I mean, you're always going to have some measure of unemployment, right? You're always going to have some, you know, even with a perfect economy, you've got those who are transitioning and moving. It seems to me it's going to be, isn't that around like 2%? You know what I'm saying? So we don't, I mean, you can't ever theoretically have 0% unemployment. So I guess my question is, with unemployment hovering in the low to mid twos, you know, functionally, it's almost like there's no unemployment, right?
Yeah, again, there's a concept of like full employment where you could have an economy that's getting as much out of the labor force as it possibly can. And then you can even say, well, it's even gone beyond that. You're really enticing otherwise idle workers to come back into the labor force because you're making it so attractive to them in terms of amount of jobs available. And if there's not enough people, then wages go higher. And suddenly you get to a point where, well, somebody on the sideline says, I'm coming back into the labor market because the wages look good and so on. Where is that magic number? I think this current environment kind of says it might be right around 2%, because this is one of the stronger environments I've ever seen in terms of economy. And I've never seen the United States labor force so restricted. And what I mean by this, what we have to realize, and why we're having conversations like this so aggressively, and why there's labor shortages across the whole country that didn't happen because of the pandemic, but were exposed by the pandemic, is because our population has gotten to a point where it's never gotten in this nation's history, and that is to 0% population growth. We've never had that. We've always had more younger workers coming. We've always had more younger population coming into the economy. But that changed. The seeds of it were set with the baby boom generation. 60, 70 years ago, you had this huge cohort of people born, came in to double the population, through their lifetimes have doubled the economy to the current size that it is, but did not reproduce themselves in enough quantity to backfill it when they were going to leave the economy. So the boomers are still around, whether they're either retired and still spending money or working and still spending money. But the point is, they're still spending money. So a lot of them now are not helping to produce goods and services, but they're consuming goods and services. And you need someone else then to make the goods and services, but they didn't make enough children to backfill it. The next thing you know, we're talking about national labor shortages. The next thing you know, we're starting to be more focused on in-migration that says, hey, if we want to have more population in the United States, it's not coming from in-house. The only place you can go get it is out of house.
Oh my gosh. I've never heard a more beautifully way of saying your civic obligation to have children, right?
Like, exactly. The answer, or your economic duty.
Your economic duty is to have children. So,
the interesting thing is, even if we did go out and have another baby boom and do that right now, it would still take 20 years before it would start to help the economy.
Got it. So the reason we're talking about, yeah, that's so interesting. So the answer is basically, this is the best it could be for labor, right? And so we've got to go find other humans because we're not having any more humans. But you know what, Mark? I guess what I said started the top of the segment off was, is there any market? Like, so I guess I'm asking the question, immigration is very important, but sometimes we are kind of restrictive in our immigration because we're trying to protect labor that's in the United States. Is there any way that we could see that there are people who are United States laborers who don't have employment? I mean, I guess my question might also be, like, if we're going after immigration, which types of workers would it might displace or would it might harm?
Asked that question 5-10 years ago, I would have had a different answer.
Gotcha.
It would have been something along the lines of what the business community was really speaking. I want this, and it's not quite in enough quantity, is higher skilled labor. It was people with higher sets of education. And, you know, internally, people can educate themselves up with opportunities and so on and go into those kind of jobs. This is the story that has changed in this country. Now it's just breathing bodies. I mean, when the pandemic hit and it kind of really put a kink in the labor force, what was happening? Burger King would close at 8. It couldn't find workers. It was the service industries, the restaurant couldn't find workers. The skill sets weren't the problem. All three of us that are on this conversation here could have gone and worked at Burger King and so on, but we didn't want to. Our skill sets were much higher than that. We're having shortages now at the very bottom, at the lowest skills, lowest paying, the service industry aspects. There was always enough bodies in the past, in our history, to fill those. They're entry-level jobs. People coming in, that's how the kids got jobs and moved their way up and so on. There's just not enough bodies right now to do it.
And that's where immigration comes in.
That's
the great dilemma in terms of what we're facing with our labor force and what our country and society, how we want to approach it.
Mark Knoll, Chief Economist with the Department of Workforce Services, thank you so much for the conversation this evening.
Well, thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.
All right, Derek Brown. Coming back after the break, we're going to have a conversation about pickleball.
Pickleball, exactly.
One of my favorite things to do on the weekend. Stay with us.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent. It was senseless. And I will never understand it. I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at night.
All right, welcome back to KSL at night. This is Derek Brown here with my co-host and good friend Leah Murray. And even more important than a co-host, she is a pickleball player.
Every weekend, Derek Brown.
Every weekend, huh?
I spend like 2.5 hours playing pickleball.
Oh, that long?
Oh, yeah.
So you can go that long.
Oh, yeah.
And not get like worn out or
oh, how
you know,
unfit do you think I am?
Well, okay, I've never really played, but the reality, and I need to sort of get up to speed here because pickleball is like without question the fastest growing sport
right.
in the country,
yeah.
like without a doubt,
without any question. And just to make it local, it's one of the fastest growing sports locally. Salt Lake City has had to add 18 new courts over the course of the last 2 years. And people are still demanding a place to play.
Everywhere. And so for those of you wondering why we're talking about this, if you're a pickleball player, like you know this and you love pickleball and you can't get enough of it. If you're not, you probably don't even know what it is. But it is the fastest growing sport anywhere. So we searched high and low for an expert in the world of pickleball. And fortunately, I happen to know one who lives across the street from me.
I love that.
And he is a student of the University of Utah and the vice president of the pickleball club. We have Jackson Bell. Jackson, thanks for joining us on KSL at Night.
Yes, of course. Thank you for having me on.
Now, you're a reformed tennis player, right?
Reformed tennis player?
Is there such a thing? Now, you were, like, you won also, I remember when you were younger, you won all sorts of competitions. You were, like, awesome at tennis. And now you're into pickleball and pretty involved at the University of Utah. First of all, tell us why. Why the switch to pickleball?
Well, I mean, like you said before, it's the fastest growing sport in America. The reason why I changed was I took a 2-year break from tennis and then I forgot everything. And then once I got back into it, I was way worse than when I started. So I figured I didn't really have a chance after high school to play in college or anything. So I was like, well, let's just pick up pickleball full time and see how it goes.
I love this, Jackson. I'll just say this for the record, playing tennis players when you're playing pickleball because they look so pretty. I can't, you know, I do not look pretty when I play pickleball, but like the tennis players come
with
all.
I do.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you do because they come with like all the beautiful, you know, the way a tennis player
exactly.
looks when it's on a pickleball court.
Okay, so Jackson, we have a lot of people listening who probably don't even understand what pickleball is. So in like 30 seconds, give us a rundown. How is pickleball different from tennis? Everyone knows what tennis looks like. How is pickleball different?
Yeah, I mean, the first biggest difference is definitely the court. You know, the court shape, I mean, so rectangular, but there's no doubles alley. There's really no service boxes. So you're left with two rectangles at the back, and those are kind of like your service boxes, and you're left with the kitchen up in front. The rule of the kitchen, the biggest rule of the kitchen is you can't step in the kitchen and hit the ball out of the area. You have to let it bounce, and then you can step in. The other difference is definitely the paddle. You know, you've got so many different paddles now. You know, your racket comes with strings on a tennis court. when you're playing tennis, you got racked with strings, but with pickleball, it's just, you know, it's either wood, it's either fiberglass, polycore, or carbon fiber. So those are the two biggest differences.
And the growth in pickleball is reflected in the fact that my understanding is you've seen a huge increase in students involved at the University of Utah from just this last year to this year, right? Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, last year was our kind of our first year as a club. We had maybe, I don't know, at the beginning, we maybe had 15 members, and then towards the end of last year, we had 20. And now this year, we started with about 45, and now we're up to, I believe, like 135. We'll call it that. So hey, huge increase.
Jackson, and what level are they all playing at? I mean, do you have a sense that most of them are entry level or a number of them like playing at like a four? I mean, I'm wondering.
When we were tabling, I mean, a lot of the people that were coming up were like, I've never even played before. I don't even have a paddle. And we're like, that's perfect. We, you know, have a couple of, we have a few 5-0s. That play on the club and who are absolutely willing to coach. And we have our competing team that's built with the 5-0s and the 4-5 level players. So, and they're always keen to help.
So I just want to tell you, so like, I was pretty full of myself and thought like I was like a 3. And then I played pickleball with someone who's really good. He's like, oh no, you're like a 2-5.
Oh no!
I got downgraded.
But this is like tennis, right? No. I mean, is it the rating kind of the same then in tennis? You know,
it's a similar construct. I mean, the way you kind of get your rating is there's an app called Duper. A lot of players are familiar with that. And then you kind of just log your matches, singles and doubles, and you put them into this app, and it kind of gives you, they have an algorithm. I don't know how it works, but then you get your rating based off that.
That's right. It's like a pickleball black box, right? You put in your stuff and it punches you out of rating.
Okay, and now I also, the one other bit of information I heard is that your team or you or a group of you at the U competed a couple weeks ago. And my understanding is you're going to go, you won something and you're off to nationals or something like that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so about like 2 weeks ago, Duper, that app, they hold a collegiate tournament. And where a bunch of colleges get to come and compete against each other. So we had our Utah regionals just barely a few weeks back. So we got to compete against Utah Tech, which they're currently rated, I believe they're number 2 in the nation right now. We played Utah State, who's, I think, in the teens. And then we played BYU Idaho or Ricks College, Grand Canyon University from there out in Arizona, and Northern Nazarene. And it was a 2-day thing. It was a Saturday, Sunday, and we took, I believe, 4th or 5th. And we had the guy who was running it walked over, and we were just kind of sitting around, not really expecting anything. And they said, hey, just so you guys know, we want to take a photo of you because we're giving you a national bid. So at our first year competing, we got a national bid, and we're going to be going out to Georgia here in November to compete against colleges across the nation.
Jackson, that is so cool. And let me just ask a question right there. So this is, it's not intramurals, but it's not division. Does that make sense? Like it's not NCAA. So where is your, it's just, how are you guys managing this? Is it in the club org zone?
And at what point are you an official sport?
And when
right?
does the university acknowledge?
It's got to be
pickleball.
Soon, right?
Yeah.
Ooh, you know, I think I was looking at the chart and I think it's about once you kind of hit your third year as a kind of club, and I think there's a certain amount of members you have to have, or a certain amount of like competing members. So it's like, I think we're hoping like next year, within these next 2 years, we're hoping to see more school funding, and more recognition as more of like a team rather than the intramural kind of co-ed club.
Yeah,
And my understanding is you guys are also like, you've got brands, right? Like that are sponsoring you guys. It's only a matter of time.
Who is your sponsor, Jackson?
Right now, we just had Vantage Pickleball. They just reached out to me and they just made a new Pro Series paddle and they sent me one to kind of give around to the competing team. And they're looking to help us with some nice paddles. I love their paddles. They're super great. Worth the check out if you're looking for a Pro Series.
Here's our last question, and I know everyone's wondering this. At what point does this become an Olympic sport, right? It's only a matter of time.
Ooh. No, you're yeah.
Right?
You're
I mean, right?
Right.
The way it's going, that I see it.
Like, next time we host the Olympics here in Utah, we'll do pickleball.
Yeah. It'll be down in St. George, right?
That's right.
Oh, you know, that's a great question. I think last time I checked, I was talking with one of the pros on the PPA tour, and they were saying that I think we're just really waiting for some more countries to be involved. I think to have to comply with Olympic ruling, I think we have to have a certain amount of countries compete. So I think right now, like U.S., obviously, we're, you know, huge into pickleball. I think Canada and Australia, they have a pro tour going on right now. But I mean, that's three right there. So I think we're just waiting for more countries. I mean,
fantastic.
We have the players.
Yeah, be a good ambassador, Jackson.
Exactly.
Get it
All
done.
Right, Jackson Bell. Jackson, the vice president of the U of U Pickleball Club. Thanks for joining us on KSL at Night, Jackson.
Yes, thank you so much.
All right, next up on KSL, we're going to talk to KSL reporter Amy Kobabe about a special that she has this weekend. Stay with us.
KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Derek Brown, as we talk about all the interesting things. And Derek, an interesting thing that's happening this weekend is General Conference.
Exactly.
And so this
happens every 6 months, and this is the weekend.
Okay. So every 6 months, and this is the weekend, and the entire week ahead of the General Conference, KSL promotes specials that will be airing during General Conference, right? So when you're listening to KSL, you're going to hear our reporters kind of previewing what they've got going on this coming weekend.
Yeah, these are great specials. I mean, they're really interesting. And these reporters spend a lot of time with this content and kind of preparing these segments. And so, for instance, you've got the Saturday afternoon session that ends at 4 p.m. And so right at 4 p.m., we have a fascinating story coming up on dating apps.
All right. So who we have with us is Amy Kobabe, KSL News Radio's Intrepid reporter. Amy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much.
So Amy, tell us, first of all, I guess I have a question. So first, when I'm done talking, you tell the listeners what it is your special is going to be about Saturday at 4 o'clock. But I'm wondering, I feel like you did this one last time. So I also want to know, what was so interesting about it that made you go for round two?
Right. So last time I really focused on some of the dangers involved with using dating apps. There are a number of research professionals working in Utah that have found that dating apps are used as hunting grounds for sexual assault. And I really wanted to continue to stay with this topic, but not so much focus on how it's being used negatively. There are a lot of success stories in Utah. If you don't know someone who has met someone on, you know, their significant other on a dating app, you're kind of in the minority. It has really grown in popularity. And so the special this time around is really how the dating world itself has just changed and how dating apps fit into all of that.
Yeah, Amy, I love how you say that because I actually went to a wedding this past weekend and how they met was a dating app,
and
right?
You know what's funny? I went to a wedding 2 weekends ago. Same thing, same
thing,
story.
Right.
And they kind of joke about it. How do we meet? And they kind of laugh and roll their eyes and go, well, we met on a dating app.
Yeah.
But the app, I mean, if it works as it should, ideally screens people and sort of takes a lot of the guesswork out and puts people that are compatible. So you're right, Amy. I mean, most of us know people who fall into that category.
Yeah, it is really popular and it's coming along. You know, so many people have one, maybe two dating apps on their phone, and it still, though, might be a big difference in, you know, trying to explain this to your parents if you're using dating apps, or trying to explain to your kids maybe how dating was 20, 30 years ago. There is so much of a generational gap now between dating that it can be kind of hard to understand what other generations have gone through or are going through. So right now, you know, a lot of people, even though it is successful, they're struggling with using dating apps. I spoke to one couple who said, you know, they were getting ghosted and they really struggled with wanting to give up and seeing other couples find these happy marriages, and they went home and were alone still. But then I caught up with them and, you know, now they're married. They have a couple of kids And the husband told me, I'm so glad that those other relationships didn't work out because they may not have loved me the way my wife loves me. They may not have been able to have this kind of relationship that we have. And so there is some hope out there. But also, you know, for anyone listening, if you're struggling with it, you're not alone. I spoke to a lot of people. I even spoke to a dating counselor, someone whose job it is to just help people date, who said it's very common for people to struggle with the apps and kind of managing this world that we live in now.
Yeah, I love this. I'm just going to tell you, I met my husband in 1998, long before there were smartphones. So I don't even know, like, the title of your thing is Swiping Left. I'm like, I don't even know what that means. Like, I have never been in a dating app. This is not my life at all. So talk to me a little bit about, how do people in Utah use the apps? You know, are there ones they like better? Does that make sense? Are there ones that they're avoiding altogether? You know, are there ones that are more popular in Utah?
So there are some more popular ones in Utah. As you might guess, there's some that are just specifically for members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I spoke to the marketing director of one called Mutual, which is for Latter-day Saint members. And that one's geared more toward younger Latter-day Saints. The kids in college usually are who are using these apps. And they say their goal really is to try and just facilitate and help people date. I liked the director I spoke to. She said, dating without a dating app is like trying to build a house without a hammer. So just try and picture that. That's kind of their philosophy, at least, when they're looking at this, is that you really can't do it without dating apps. The dating coach that I spoke to suggested, if you're a little bit older, using dating apps like Hinge. She said that more long-term relationships have kind of come from Hinge. And she said, you know, maybe steer away from others like Tinder. Even though they're not bad, she said they just kind of have a connotation that goes along with them that can be more looking for a one-night stand or something more short-term. So there's kind of something for everyone, and that's why a lot of people have multiple. They're looking on one or two of these, whereas, you know, 10 years ago, just having a website or something where someone is building a profile, now multiple profiles, and people who are using these are finding that, you know, they're going on a lot more first dates, and it might not turn into second dates unless they kind of, the coach I spoke to said, people are looking for this feeling. They want to feel something immediately, kind of on a first date. She said, that's really hard. It's kind of changed the dating culture because that doesn't happen on a first date. That's not ever how it's kind of worked, but we've kind of built up this expectation. And so she says that's been hard for a lot of people to overcome. But once they do, they find a lot more success.
Well, and it makes sense because, you know, if the app does its job, in theory, it screens out people that you're not going to be compatible with. Right. And so I can see, I mean, your point of that is one of your, you know, stronger tools in terms of dating. It wasn't always the case. I mean, right, Leah, early on, I remember when people would talk about the fact that they met online. Now, this is probably 15 years ago.
Right. I mean, when it was black and white television.
Well, exactly. Yeah, exactly. But I remember when it was like, you know, we met on, like, someone going online. It was sort of like, I've exhausted all my other alternatives.
Right.
At all. What the heck? Let's go for the Hail Mary. But now it's very mainstream.
It's the first step.
Exactly. And like you said, Amy, all of us know people that, you know, that have success stories. And it's funny that you mentioned that. And both Leah and I, in the last couple of weeks, have gone to weddings where that's how they met.
Yeah.
And so is that real? Give us, you know, in the last few moments that we have here, give us the nutshell version of kind of where you're going with this article and this piece you're doing.
Well, I really just want to help people to understand, you know, if you have dated online and, you know, it's not the last resort, as you said, you know, there are some ways that you can improve that, and also just do it in a healthy way that's healthy for your mental health. And if you're not dating online, if you were lucky enough to meet your significant other, you know, through mutual friends or at church or something like that in the past, this might help you understand maybe what your kids are going through. It might help you understand a little bit of just what your, you know, the future looks like. And so instead of saying something like, oh, I could never do that, that's, you know, I'm so grateful, you can understand, oh, it's not impossible. There is just, people find a way to fall in love still. And even though it's changed dramatically, it's still working for a lot of people.
Oh my gosh. Amy Kobe, I'm going to watch this so I can learn what swiping left means. Amy Kobe, KSL News Radio, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Leah. Thanks, Derek.
Okay, Derek, next up on KSL at Night, let's have a conversation about the fact that a New York State judge found that former President Trump committed fraud.
KSL at Night. KSL at Night.
All right, welcome back to KSL at Night. This is Derek Brown here with my co-host and good friend Leah Murray. And I know you may think there are a lot of lawsuits going on involving former President Trump. And there are really four federal cases that we've been following right around the country. You've got Georgia.
Isn't that a state case, though?
Florida. Ooh, I think it may be federal. Georgia, Florida, we've got New York, and we've got D.C.
Right.
But there is another one that I haven't been following as closely, and it involves allegations that President Trump committed fraud in the process of building his real estate empire.
That's right.
And
the thing is, I will just tell you, so listeners may remember or know, I grew up in the state of New York, and New York's attorney general has a ton of power. Right. So oftentimes people think it is equal almost to the governor. Does that make sense? Like, and many of our governors, Andrew Cuomo, Eliot Spitzer, and I say our, I live in Utah now, our governor is Spencer Cox, but many of New York's governors come out of the attorney general's office, right? Like, it is a major seat of power in New York State. And the current attorney general of New York is Letitia James. And I remember when she was elected, I thought, oh, here we go. Because
he's in trouble.
He's in trouble. She is going to come for that former president, and she doesn't care.
Really? Right.
And the office affords her all sorts of latitude. Does that make sense? Like, they've all just had all sorts of latitude.
And so what's interesting is Trump, as you know, has highly resisted the disclosure of his tax returns. I mean, he's done this for as long as we can remember. And that may have everything to do with this case here involving fraud at a state level in New York. And so we have on with us, joining us, KSL's legal analyst, Greg Skordas, to talk a little bit about what's going on in this case and what just happened today. So, Greg, welcome to KSL at Night.
Hey, it's nice to be with both you guys.
So, first of all, tell us a little bit about this case, because as I mentioned earlier to Leah, I mean, a lot of the other ones I've been following closely, but I'll bet most people like me have not really been following this case, which in the end could be like the one that kind of brings him down. So tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Okay, so just to clear up a couple of things that you guys talked about, there are currently four pending criminal cases, two state cases, New York and Georgia, and two federal cases. Those are Florida and D.C. The case we're talking about today is a civil case. It is not a criminal case, but you're right, Derek. It's a substantial civil case, because what the New York Attorney General is alleging in this case is that the former President Trump lied, misrepresented his assets in order to obtain some insurance and some loans and things like that. And in fact, what she's claiming is that he overstated his assets by as much as $2.2 billion. So the state is seeking, in a civil context, a punishment against him, a sanction of $250 million. That case is scheduled to go to trial potentially on Monday. And what happened here, and I'm making a short story longer than I needed to, but what's happened here is, as they're preparing for trial, he and his attorneys have now been sanctioned by $110,000 and held in contempt, because they are abusing the discovery rules. In other words, they're not complying with the civil rules of discovery in terms of disclosing documents, answering questions appropriately, and otherwise allowing the state of New York to prepare its civil case. The civil rules of discovery are a lot different than criminal, because you can't say, hey, I have Fifth Amendment, I don't need to disclose this and that. You know, it's a civil case and it's about money. You've got to disclose the information.
So, Greg, talk about the sanctions of the attorney. That's very rare. I mean, how often do you see attorneys get sanctioned in your practice?
Oh, very, very rarely. And you're exactly right, Derek. The attorneys themselves were each sanctioned and fined another $7,500 for playing fast and loose with the rules.
So what do they do? What do they do to get sanctioned? It seems like everywhere the President Trump goes, these kind of things happen. Why would they let themselves get in that position where they're being sanctioned? Because this seems like a very bad harbinger of what's to come if you're former President Trump.
Oh, yeah. But keep in mind, Derek, these attorneys made a lot more than $7,500 in preparation for this case. So maybe it's a drop in the bucket. And maybe their client is just so difficult to deal with that they just couldn't get the information. But the judge isn't finding that necessarily. The judge is finding that the attorneys themselves misled, withheld, and otherwise, made the disclosure of evidence much more difficult. And you're right. You're absolutely right, Derek. That's rare, and it looks poorly for attorneys because if an attorney in Utah got sanctioned by a judge $7,500, you can bet that the Utah State Bar would look dimly on that and maybe even consider something with respect to an attorney's licensure.
So, Greg, talk to me about this finding that the defendants committed fraud under the state civil law. Then it's the case the judge determines, and I'm reading this in a Washington Post article, at a bench trial, whether illegal conduct occurred. So can you explain, this judge is saying, I'm sanctioning all of you for misbehaving, right? I've decided that you did commit fraud. So does that mean it's over? What is the bench trial that might start Monday?
So the only issue, that's a great question, Leah. The only question left is how much. So the judge has determined that there was fraud. Judge has determined that there was misrepresentation by the attorneys and the defendant, who was Donald Trump. So the issue of liability has been determined. But the second issue in a civil case is always damages. So we have fault, that's established. Now we're going to go to trial on what's the appropriate punishment for that. What are the damages? And the state, like I said earlier, is seeking something like $250 million. I think it would be unlikely that a judge would give an award like that, although this judge is really upset. And what we're really talking about here is the judge issuing that sanction and then the Trump attorneys appealing it to the Supreme Court of New York in that court, or the appellate court, rather, in New York. And that court has said, nope, the judge was right. We're affirming that contempt order. They backed up what the judge did.
And so, Greg, you mentioned there's four other cases that are pending. Now, am I correct that all four of those other cases stem from actions taken during or after his presidency? This one, as I understand, goes back like a decade or more. Like, this predates him even announcing his run for president.
Correct. And just to be 100% accurate, one of the criminal cases is before he was president, because it's the payoff of the
Stormy Daniels. That's correct.
Yeah, the Stormy Daniels. So that one was slightly before he assumed the presidency. But you're right otherwise. Yeah, this is just is securing loans and getting money and applying for proceeds and things like that. They're saying that the Trump organization misled their assets and overstated. If you're borrowing money to, let's say, to buy a house, and you overstate your other assets, you lie about the wealth that you have in order to get a loan, to secure a loan, that's fraud. That's loan fraud. And it could be criminal, too. But in this case, it's a civil sanction that the state of New York is seeking in that particular case.
And just out of curiosity, why is it that the state cares when they're not the ones that provided the loans? It seems to me the person who would care would be whoever it is that's giving, providing the loan when the value is overstated.
You're exactly right. But oftentimes when somebody has come in and applied for money, even in Utah, and a bank feels like they've been aggrieved, they can go to the state, they can go to the attorney general's office, they can go to their fraud unit and seek some help in doing that. But I think even the state has an interest in making sure that its lenders are treated appropriately, and that people that are borrowing money, especially significant amounts of money, are doing that by telling the truth and accurately stating their income and their net worth.
Fantastic. All right, Greg Skordas, legal analyst for KSL. Thank you for joining us.
You bet.
All right. Next up on KSL at Night, there are a lot of incredibly newsworthy things that happened today. In addition to this case that we just talked about, we're going to break it down one by one after the break.
KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Derek Brown, as we talk about all the news of the day. And since we bill ourselves as the best 2 hours of radio for you to possibly learn all the things you need to know, we're going to do a number of stories like, I don't know, speed dating news coverage.
Exactly. Well, that, which is what we have to do because there's so much that has happened today around the country that, you know, let's hit each of them.
Yeah. So I want to start off with President Biden. For the first time ever in history, we've got a president going to the picket line. So today there are auto workers, United Auto Workers are striking. They feel like they would like a 40% wage increase over 40 years. They would like to have better benefits. They feel like whatever it is the case that causes the CEOs to make a lot more money should be trickling down into their pockets since they're the ones who actually make the cars. And a little bit, Derek, I think what's interesting here is President Biden was receiving some criticism for being what he calls a self-proclaimed pro-labor president, but also being kind of chummy with General Motors. Does that make sense? So he is hanging with the CEO that these auto workers are protesting against.
Well, and I think the other question is who gets – I think – He's rummaging for an endorsement. Let's be clear. That's what it comes down to. Because I think in 2016, I think Trump got this endorsement of the United Auto Workers.
But and in 2020, he got it. Biden right?
got it. And so now, and Trump is making he's making a case for it. I mean, I don't think they've officially endorsed anyone. I think Trump is going to be meeting with them as well. And so this is Biden's way of saying, I'm going to one-up Trump here by actually showing up on the picket line. Which, you know, whether that was a good move, you know, I'm sure we could debate that. And I have some strong opinions about that. But he grabbed a bullhorn and he just started, you know, saying, you know, you deserve more. So,
yeah.
I mean, if you're going to try and negotiate, you know, I guess if you're a labor union trying to negotiate for a 40% increase to have, you know, the current president of the United States show up and join you at the picket line, I guess, you know, that's a pretty that's quite the bully pulpit.
Right. And I think it's interesting. I mean, what I thought was interesting, there was a quote from a worker who was protesting saying, this is really not about us, right? So like, Biden's coming today, Trump will be there tomorrow. And a little bit, I think, Derek, what gets lost is what these workers are looking for, what they are striking for when we are having conversations about the strike as a political
game. A tool.
Does that make sense? A tool
exactly.
for either one of these candidates. But what's interesting is having a president show up on the picket line, right? That's never happened before. And, right, you know, he did grab a bullhorn. They asked him if they deserved the money. He said, yeah. So he's coming down on the side of give these people all a raise, which is just interesting.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about the greatest emergency that we always see coming miles and miles away.
Why? It's 4 days away from September 30th? What?
Exactly. And that is the government shutdown. And this is the most predictable manufactured crisis. When I worked in D.C., like it was almost a running joke. And they just keep it going. We know when the government spending runs out. And rather than dealing with it ahead of time, they wait until the very, very last second. And then at the clock is almost about to strike midnight, they come up with a deal and everyone walks away and pats themselves on the back. So that's what's going on now. What remains to be seen is who gets what leading up to that.
Right. And I want to remind our listeners that we are pre-recorded, so it's possible in the hour from when we are recording this to when they are listening, something huge might have changed. But from what we're talking about, the Senate seems to have brokered some kind of stopgap deal, right?
Exactly. So they've got enough to – what they've done is they've passed a vehicle that I think they can send over to the House. And then the House can use that kind of as a vehicle for dealing with things. The big debate in the Senate is Ukrainian funding and how much should or should not be put into the war. In the House, the question is immigration funding. Mm-hmm. And so,
or border security.
Border
right?
security, right. Exactly. And so those are the different competing interests. And so I was texting with someone who, let's just say, is very close to members of Congress. And I referred to the disarray in the House. And this friend of mine responded and said, "It's not disarray, Derek. It's just the process.
Just the process.
Just the process." And you know what?
Because guess what? The process is disarray.
It is. And, right. and that's okay, because one person's disarray is another person's victory. I mean, it's all in the eye of the beholder. And so we'll see what happens. And it will be this kind of messy sausage-making process until they come up with a deal, because I'm going out on a limb here. But my limb says we're not going to default on our national debts. We are going to pass something before the funding runs out.
Yeah, so that's a limb, right? But that's something different than shutting down the government. So the question really is, will you be able to get a passport next month, right?
Exactly.
Like, when, you know, it's like a little more. And the thing that bothers me a little bit, I'm sorry, let me just do a little Leah indignation.
You can rant here.
Right?
There we
just
go.
Just a little bit of a rant. If the government shuts down, I have students who are working. One of my students works for the IRS, and he's like, "Yeah, I don't know if I can pay for my rent." Literally is in his head yesterday in my class. If they shut down the government and I'm no longer working, how do I pay for my rent? But meanwhile, Derek, like, Congress members still collect a salary. So part of me wishes, man, you know what?
What's sauce for the goose or sauce for the gander?
If you are playing these games, and I understand it, and I'm a fan, right? Like, I'm totally a political junkie, then really you should be reaping the cost the same way that my IRS working student sitting in my classroom.
Yeah, they shouldn't be exempt. And I agree with that. I think it should be an all or nothing. And the ramifications for closing down the government. And by the way, it's always interesting to see which agencies and individuals are, what are they, essential?
Indispensable. That's what it is.
Versus
essential.
Non-essential.
That's right.
The one and only time in my life I ever went to Maui was probably 20 plus years ago. And I was there right when they had a government shutdown.
Because you were non-essential?
And well, no, I'm saying the people
there.
So like the national park there, I couldn't get in.
You couldn't go.
Because that was non-essential.
I
and so I've actually always wanted to go back and never have. But anyway, so we'll see what happens. That'll come down here shortly.
All right. So one last one in the last minute or so that we've got that I'm hoping maybe you have some insight on is that the FTC has sued alongside 17 states, Amazon, over allegations that it inflates online prices and it overcharges sellers. So the FTC, Derek, right, is the Federal Trade Commission basically joining these 17 states, saying that they're violating antitrust laws, asking the court to issue a permanent injunction. So what does that mean? I can't order off of Amazon? Derek, tell me what that means.
Well, I think what it means is it's a reflection on the size of Amazon.
Okay.
And
what does
so
that mean?
This meaning,
explain that.
Meaning, I mean, if the FTC is coming in, they're the ones that have the regulatory authority to, in theory, break up a company that's too large. Now, they rarely do that, but they will go after companies for violations of antitrust laws, which basically means you have, because of the size of your company, you have acted in a way that impedes competition and impedes the free market. And so my sense as I look at this is that Amazon is kind of taking over the world, and I use them all the time. I'm an Amazon Prime member.
Yeah,
and
me
because
too.
I mean, I love the fact that I can click a button and something's on my doorstep by that evening.
No kidding. Isn't that crazy? Or by like 7 the next morning. I mean, a little bit, I think, okay.
I know. It's like, and if the question is they're inflating their prices, well, you know, that remains to be seen. But I think this will play out over, it'll take several years because antitrust cases take a long time. But I think people do, we joke about the size of Amazon, but the reality is you can only get so big as a company in America before the regulators start to take notice. And I think it's just inevitable that a company like Amazon, you know, at some point, the FTC is going to
come looking at the books.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, Derek, thank you so much for that. I love that. Speed dating of news stories. I love that segment. Okay, next up on KSL at Night, stay with us because we are going to have a hard conversation about a tragedy at the U.S.-Mexico border. A 2-month-old infant was found abandoned, and News Nation will join us with the details.
KSL at Night.
All right, welcome back to KSL at Night. This is Derek Brown, your host, with my good friend and co-host, Leah Murray. And we've got kind of a disturbing story, but one that's probably something we ought to cover and talk about because it has so much to do with not only what's happening in a part of the country, but I think it has an impact on what's happening in D.C. And in fact, right now, as they're negotiating the budget.
Right.
And so, and this is to, we want to talk about some of the conditions taking place along the border, and particularly the Rio Grande area. And so there's a story that came out recently, and Allie Bradley, who is News Nation Southwest correspondent, reported on this. And we are lucky to have her with us on KSL at Night. Allie, thanks for joining the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
So why don't you start by giving us a rundown of the story that you wrote about. And then, well, kind of we'll talk through some of the details, but it's obviously heartbreaking. But why don't you start with that and then let that set the stage for our conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So the story that we were reporting on today is that a two-month-old baby was actually found by Rio Grande City agents down in the Rio Grande Valley sector that was abandoned. And I just actually got a statement from Customs and Border Patrol who says, quote, agents encountered a group of non-citizens near La Grulla, Texas. A woman in that group informed agents that she had encountered an abandoned infant in a park with a backpack containing formula and diapers. The child was medically evaluated and efforts are ongoing to identify the child and relatives. Of course, this child has no identification on them. They have no way to really identify any relatives unless someone comes forward, a sponsor, a family member, or anything like that. What's really shocking, the age of this child, you guys, I've been covering the southern border exclusively for over 2 years, and I've seen toddlers down there. It's heartbreaking to see that, to see 1- and 2-year-olds. But I've never seen a child so young, and even in talking to Border Patrol today, they kind of said the same thing. You know, we've seen toddlers down there, but they too, you know, a child this young and this kind of what they call tender age is just, it's very shocking. It's very heartbreaking, but it is a tactic that the cartels are using, and they're using it more and more. And I talked with a retired ICE HSI special agent who actually dealt heavily with human trafficking while he was working with the agency, and he told me that the cartel are actually using these children as payment, you know, from people. People are actually, if they can't pay, they'll pay with their kids. Maybe they have 2 or 3 children, and they say, hey, you know, leave that little one here. We'll reconnect them with you later on. You know, we promise we'll get them to you on the other side. And a lot of times we see these little kids with note cards, and they have a phone number or an address on them. I've actually been present and called one of the parents on that note card, and she nonchalantly was saying, well, we told them to give them to that lady. And so the agents have to kind of trust what's on that note card, is what Victor Avila was saying with HSI. And so you have all these different elements at play here. You have a child who no one can identify, 2 months old, obviously in need of a mother, a formula, a diaper, right? Obvious care is needed in a child that little. And then you have how to identify that child. And so that is the next step. And we know that HHS has nearly 11,000 children currently in custody. They're seeing an average of 380 children coming across alone every single day. That's what's happening right now at the southern border. And this little infant right now is just kind of, unfortunately, the picture of this crisis right now.
So, Allie, talk to us a little bit about how does this benefit the cartel at all? Because my understanding is, I mean, when I read this story, my assumption is this is the 2023 version of the stories that you would have heard in, you know, 16th, 17th century London or something, where a mother who couldn't raise her child would leave it in a, you know, on a doorstep for someone who had the means to do so. I mean, so when I read your story, I thought, okay, this must be a mother who knows, you know, if they're leaving it with formula, she's leaving it in a place where she knows the child will be found and ideally have a better life, a better circumstance. But you're saying there's a cartel element to this beyond that.
Absolutely. And what Victor Avila is saying is that the majority of these abandoned children are actually left by the parent. And I don't know this mother's circumstances as to what happened, why she abandoned this 2-month-old over in Texas. I don't know. But the reality here is that these individuals, when the cartel gets involved, the administration right now has made it very clear that family units and people with children are not going to have as hard of a time getting into the country as somebody that doesn't have a child. And so the cartel wants to move these people, wants to keep these people moving. So Victor is even telling me that sometimes these people that don't have a child are given a child without even having to pay a fee to cross the southern border, because the cartel wants to move people. they can make their money in their $13 billion industry as long as people are moving. It's a very lucrative business. So in order to have these single adults, which that's the vast majority that come across the southern border, in order to ensure that they're going to get across, they, again, some of these families, these women will unfortunately, either the cartel takes the kid, the parent leaves them with the cartel as payment, or, you know, I don't even want to think about the unfathomable things that might happen to that child and why that's left there. But that's the reality we have to look at. We have to look at the cartel will be forcibly taking these children, and the parents are also using their children as payment. And so that's what we are seeing. Now, there are circumstances, I am absolutely sure, where you're talking about, where the woman, maybe she felt like she couldn't care for that baby anymore. But the fact of the matter is this. If you're bringing a baby into the United States as an undocumented individual, you know, and everybody knows, because the messaging is very clear in that space for these migrants, that they are not going to be turned away and that they aren't going to be treated poorly with a child. And that is the messaging that is being sent back to all the way down to Tapachula and beyond that these migrants are getting, is if they have a child with them, the likelihood of them getting in is going to be greater.
So, Allie, can you talk to me? One of the numbers that you reported in this article that we were reading was that there was a 73% rise in unaccompanied minors from June to August. So I'm wondering, like, because you're saying it's messaging, right? And I understand that totally. But that seems like a big jump, and the administration hasn't changed, right? And their messaging hasn't changed.
But,
do you have a sense of
no,
like...
No, they have.
Okay,
they
go
have.
Ahead. Go
Title
explain
42,
that.
Title 42 ended in May. We saw a massive lull in everything in June. So the policy did change. Everything slowed down dramatically in June. So there is a big jump after that slowdown, right? So you
gotcha.
Have to compare... that when you go from June to August, there's going to be a really big jump because there's a pretty big sink. There's a low. And the reality is, and I've been reporting this very widely and openly, that it wasn't necessarily an if, but when the levee was going to break, because there were hundreds of thousands of people in Mexico waiting to come to the U.S. So right now we're seeing the fractures all along the southern border. We're seeing the numbers up, and they've been up for quite a while. We're just now seeing it everywhere. And we're seeing, you know, 233,000 people crossed in August. You know, that's the highest this calendar year. So the policy did change. Title 42 went away. The cartel was sitting there waiting in June to figure out how we were going to implement Title 8. Were we going to turn people right back around that crossed between the ports of entry and say they are ineligible for asylum for 5 years? That's what it was, the messaging that was sent out. But when you look at the month of June, that's not what happened. People were released into the country under removal proceedings, which means that they get a court date that's 2 to 5 years out. So the cartel sees, okay, they're not turning every single person around and saying you're not eligible for asylum. They're not getting into our profits here. They're letting us continue to operate. Let's go. They continue to send them, and these people continue to be released in the country with a court date under removal proceedings, and that's what the administration calls it.
Gotcha. Oh my gosh!
Oh, it's heartbreaking, and I've got to think, Allie, as well. You know, this is an issue. I'm assuming, I mean, from what I'm hearing, is part of the discussions in Congress right now in the House is funding with, you know, from a budget standpoint, funding immigration. And so I'm assuming, and literally like today, we've been covering this, and on KSL, we've been talking about the fact that they are negotiating budget in the House right now. And I've got to think that this story that you've reported, and, you know, situations like this are only making that, you know, that budgetary process even more contentious and heartbreaking. So anyway, well, Allie, thank you so much for joining us on KSL at Night. We appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Take care. If you ever have any border questions, I'm your gal.
Yes,
thank you,
you are.
Allie, I love it.
All right. Next up on KSL Night, we're going to talk about the second Republican debate that is tomorrow evening, and we're going to give you the rundown of what to expect. Stay with us.
KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside Derek Brown. And Derek, we always have such a good time having conversations, or at least I do. I hope you do.
Oh, I have a great time. Oh, this is more fun than my day job.
I love that. Oh, I can't say that out loud on radio. Someone might hear me. But yeah, this is so much fun. So tomorrow night, right? Second Republican primary debate.
Debate at the Ronald Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California.
Yeah. So,
I've actually been, I don't know if you've ever been there.
It
is phenomenally interesting, and I don't know where they'll position it. I know in the past they've done it. But in the very middle of the of this museum, they have the 747 aircraft that was Air Force One for Ronald Reagan.
So wait a minute, the Air Force One is inside the museum?
It is inside the museum.
How big is this museum?
It's massive.
Okay.
It is massive. Huge. So yeah. They have a big sort of central area with you know windows on the top, but they disassembled it. They had just the main fuselage, which they were able to transport. You know, apparently closing down freeways late at night, you know, when they built this. But then they reassembled it there inside the you know, it's the size of an airplane hangar. And it's very cool. You could go in and you can see the, you know, from where the pilot sat, you can see where Reagan sat, where the bedroom was, where the press operated. It's very cool.
That is really cool. Well, anyway, sorry, I totally got distracted by history.
When I saw that it was at Ronald Reagan Airport or the museum.
So basically what's going to happen is tomorrow night, Dana Perino, who is Fox News co-anchor of America's Newsroom, Fox News's morning show, is going to be the moderator. So this is the first time she's the moderator. One of three for the second debate. First time she's moderated. So she's kind of, I feel like I know her name from the George W. Bush.
I think she was the press secretary.
Is that what it was? Okay. So I'm like, old information in my head was like, I know this name from before. and so she, along with two other people, will be having a conversation with which candidates of the Republican Party.
So there's seven of them. Why don't we go through the requirements?
Because you want to start there?
This is a little bit new. Because if let's set the requirements, then we can talk about who's actually going to be debating. In the past, and everybody who's listening is probably familiar with the fact that you've got to have some sort of weeding process. So not anybody who files to run.
You don't have to. You could be like the Democrats and have 22 people on a stage, which is not a good idea.
You could. I served as the Republican Party chair here. And, you know, it was funny to watch who came through as, you know, potential candidates when I was, Kanye was one.
Right.
I mean, like there was this whole group. But so what the Republican Party does is they weed out those and to where you are only leaving those who legitimately have a shot at getting the nomination.
And who does the weeding? Like, so we're going to talk about what the requirements are.
Yes.
It's the RNC that does that?
Yes, I believe that, or that they have a commission that's part of the RNC. And
okay.
In the past, they've always had, it's mostly a polling requirement. Once you reach a threshold, like in national polls of like 3% or 5%, then you qualify.
I feel like for the presidential debate commission, right? It's 5%. Isn't it? Like that's why we had one time at Ross Perot on the stage because he was actually polling.
For the debate commission itself.
Right.
But for the Republican Party, they'll change those requirements. And there are three things that they have required. Number one, you've got to be at 3%. On average in national polls. So one is polls. Number two is a pledge, which basically says you pledge you're going to support whoever it is that comes out of the convention, which you would think is a no-brainer, but isn't necessarily the case. And then number three, and the big one, and this is a new one, and that is donors. They want you to have a certain number of donors. And so for tomorrow's debate, they have upped the number. You have to have 50,000 individual donors and you have to have at least 200 donors in 20 different states or territories.
So basically what they're looking for is viability, right? So they're
exactly.
So I've got to have the donors can't be my mom, right? Like, so even if I had like $1 billion, it can't all come from, right?
And I had forgotten that they're upping this even more for the third debate. Now, so last night, Mike Pence was here in Utah.
Yeah.
So I went to an event where he spoke and he talked about why he should be amongst those who, you know, why you should vote for him, essentially. And he kind of made his pitch for, you know, why a Pence presidency is the one. Now, whether you think he can actually get the nomination or not is another story. I personally don't see a pathway for that to happen. I think he's polling anywhere. And in fact, he joked about it. He said, you know, I'm polling anywhere from 5%. To never heard of him. So he sort of joked about that. But he did say, look, you know, ask your friends and family to donate to me, even if it's only $1, because, and then he made this comment. He said, I need to have 70,000 individual donors
for the next
debate.
Because he made the stage tomorrow.
Yes, he made it tomorrow. I don't know if he's made the 70,000 yet, but that is, they're whittling it down. So tomorrow there's seven. So let's go through the seven candidates.
Yep.
So not surprisingly, you have Ron DeSantis,
Florida governor.
Florida governor. You have Vivek Ramaswamy,
who's an entrepreneur
and has really kind of made an interest. He's like the one, he casts himself as sort of the outsider.
Yeah.
And is kind of an interesting sort of non-traditional candidate.
Yep.
You have Nikki Haley.
Former UN ambassador, former governor of South Carolina.
Yes. Mike Pence, who's the former vice president. Chris Christie, who is the former governor of
New Jersey.
Tim Scott.
South Carolina senator.
And then Doug Burgum.
Right, who is a North Dakota governor.
And it's funny, he's one that I don't know much about, frankly, and the fact that he has gotten 50,000 individual donors, I mean, in my mind, you know, he should be on the stage if you
can get
that many.
But here's a name that's not on the stage, and that is Donald Trump. So one, instead of going to the primary debate, he is going to be in Michigan, and we talked about it earlier on the show, because he'll be there picketing.
With the auto workers who are on strike. Trying to get their endorsement.
Right.
Which he got in 2016 and lost in 2020.
So there's that. But he also technically, Derek, shouldn't be on the stage because he wouldn't have met the Min Quals, right?
So talk about what that is. I mean, talk about why it is that
clearly,
even if he wanted to,
he wouldn't be there. He's got the polling, obviously. He's got the donors, obviously. But he has not been willing to sign a pledge that says he would back any nominee. So what Donald Trump basically is saying is, if I'm not the nominee for the Republican Party,
then no one should be the nominee.
I don't know that he's saying I would never support somebody, but he's not promising to support somebody. So, I mean, but let me ask you that question right there. Let's say he calls tomorrow and he's like, dude, actually, I want to come. I'm in Michigan. I feel like I can get to California fast. I want to be there. They don't let him on the stage?
No, at this point they don't. I mean, unless he meets the requirements.
Okay.
So I think that's the reality we had in the first debate. I mean, there were several individuals who were running, like Larry Elder, who just didn't meet the requirements and were pretty upset about it, and they felt like it was unfair.
Yeah.
But the reality is, if you are a party, I mean, your job is to introduce your different candidates to the voters and to introduce, you know, if someone legitimately is just not going to make the nomination, I mean, you're doing your people a disservice by putting them out there. You know what I'm saying? Like you really want to introduce them and make the case for who it is that can win. So anyway, it's always tricky because individuals get left out. And in fact, someone is getting left out tomorrow.
Yeah.
Who was there before. And that's Asa Hutchinson.
Asa Hutchinson, right. Right. And I feel like Doug Burgum just got in like 5 seconds ago or something.
Exactly. Like
he really just made it a minute ago.
So Hutchinson has signed the pledge,
right,
but he doesn't have the donors and he doesn't have the poll numbers. And
so he's
out tomorrow.
Right.
And so my guess is then when we have the third debate, you're going to have, of these seven, we're going to wind it down to maybe five.
That's right.
Because you've got to have now 70,000 individual donors.
That's right. It's getting interesting.
Absolutely.
Okay, Derek, next up on KSL at Night, earlier we talked about pickleball. Let's talk about it some more. Except how maybe it intersects with politics. After the break.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. And as we wrap up a really fun 2 hours, this is the funnest 2 hours I've had in a long time. This is Derek Brown, by the way, and I'm here with Leah Murray.
That can't be the funnest 2 hours. You played in Nashville. You played a Steinway.
I did. Elvis Presley played.
That had to be the funnest.
That was fun. And I did play in a Nashville band, but only because my wife outed me to the band in the honky-tonk bar.
But you looked like you were having fun. I saw the video.
I had a blast. In a previous life, I was a musician.
In some alternate quantum universe, there is a Derek Brown who
plays in honky-tonk bars in Nashville. And oh, how much fun that is. So second only to being in Nashville, the last 2 hours have been a lot of fun. And in fact, we've covered everything from very serious topics like tragedies along the border to discussions in D.C. to one of the funnest topics we've talked about in a long time, pickleball.
That's right. So the sport of pickleball, which we talked about earlier.
When we talked with a student at the U.
That's right. Who's
building it. Jackson Bell is like the vice president of the pickleball club.
Right.
And right now it's a club. And my guess is, I mean, you know, the university set up better than I do, but I'm assuming in the next year or two, the U will probably make it an official intercollegiate sport.
So, and the nice thing about it is very easily, how do I say, Title IX scholarships would be easy because men and women could play. It is co-ed. Does that make sense? Like you could literally, right? Yep. So, but the thing is, 48 million Americans are playing it regularly, according to the founder of Major League Pickleball, this professional league that was created, kind of like Jackson is doing, you know, not Division I, it's not NCAA sponsored yet, but right, like in those zones. In the last 2 years, Salt Lake City, like we said earlier, has built 18 courts across the city to make sure people, you know, can play pickleball when they want to play. But here's my favorite story. In the Senate, the United States Senate, inside of the Dirksen building, they have built them a pickleball court. And the cutest thing, Derek, is there's stars. So the court is blue, like the lines are red, and then the kitchen is full of stars. It is the most patriotic pickleball I have ever seen.
I love it. Well, and here's the best part is you have members of the Senate who are playing against each other, and it's a bipartisan pickleball caucus of sorts. I mean, how great is that?
I know.
And you know what? This is something that we are, I mean, if there's one thing we're missing in D.C., it is this kind of element. So I used to work in D.C., and, you know, I worked for Senator Bob Bennett. And he made the comment that, now this is probably 15 years ago, he said, things have changed because you have so many members of Congress now commuting into D.C. that they don't really stick around for the weekends and hang out as individuals.
They don't become friends.
Right. They don't have a chance to socialize. And I remember Senator Bennett one time saying to me, he said in the older days, and Senator Hatch used to say this as well, you got to know the spouses of your colleagues. You got to know their families. Like you got to see them interact.
They all lived there.
They lived there. That's
right.
You know, I mean, now it's a lot easier with technology. I mean, all of our members of Congress now just commute to D.C. because you can. You know, most of them will leave on a Monday morning flight with Delta, and they'll come back on Thursday late afternoon. And then the benefit is then they can spend 3 days here in Utah meeting with Utahns. So I mean, that's helpful for Utah, but it's not necessarily helpful.
It's not good for the nation.
To get to know their colleagues.
Yeah.
And so then it becomes a lot easier if you don't know someone to dehumanize them and, you know, just and treat them in an unprofessional or uncivil manner.
It adds to the coarseness, right, that we see happening, I think, in American politics at the highest levels. I think you're absolutely right. What I love about this, so there's a quote in this article I'm reading off of NPR, where Senator Tom Tillis, a Republican from North Carolina, says, it's kind of hard to treat people in an untoward way if you've been out on a pickleball court with them. Right? Like, so the answer is,
exactly.
If I have played a game with you, do you know what I'm saying? Like, that goes a long way to making you someone I can have a conversation with. And I think like a lot of what's happening in the world right now is, you know, we use these metaphor, if you will, of heavy, like conversations are heavy, right? Right. And the problem is we haven't built the infrastructure in our relationships to have the heavy conversations. So if Congress members are only seeing each other Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and it's always a hot mess, it's always this disarray, which it should be. And I'm a fan of the disarray, but I never see you over coffee or having like a drink of, you know, orange juice in the morning. I don't see you at like the cafeteria. We're not having lunch together. I never build the infrastructure necessary to make the conversation about how you solve the border crisis even possible.
Exactly.
Right. And not that I'm saying like pickleball is going to save it, but oh my gosh, would I love it if pickleball saved it. But the answer is like, if I'm here and we are playing, we are building relationship bridges. Right. So that later I go, all right, I trust you enough. Jeremy, you've been my partner in pickleball. I trust you enough. Let's have a conversation about what do we do with children at the border who are coming over unaccompanied. And I see you as the human that you are and the dignity of your human self. Does that make sense? Yeah. So.
And this is the problem with the online social media world that we live in, is that it's very easy to dehumanize someone who's just an avatar.
It's very easy to unfriend somebody who says something you don't want to hear.
Exactly. And then you end up in a bubble with people that think exactly like you do, which is totally unhelpful.
It's unhealthful and unhealthy.
Unhealthy.
Right?
And intellectually, it's
boring.
It's like McDonald's, you know. I mean, and how many people are like, just like their social media feed, like it's all McDonald's.
That's right.
Right.
So the answer is like, Derek, I think you and I disagree probably on a number of policy issues.
So we should play pickleball. Let's start there.
But the point is, we've spent a lot of time together in these bits, having these conversations, getting to know each other. Right. And like, all of a sudden you're like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, like, well,
And what it does is it creates an environment. And this is the thing that I really wish that we had in D.C. It creates the environment socially where if you say something that I think is just crazy or outlandish or ridiculous, like we have a deep enough like relationship of trust that it forces me to go, OK, wait a minute. Like, I know Leah.
Right.
And if that's how she feels, Derek, what are you missing?
Right.
Like, rethink this, Derek. You know what I'm saying? Like, it causes me to be more introspective because I have that existing relationship with you that is, that can only come over time and maybe having hard conversations.
No, that's totally right. And I love, like, right there, because what Jefferson, I hate quoting Thomas Jefferson, I'll just tell you, he's not my favorite founding father. My favorite is Alexander Hamilton, but I'll give Jefferson his due on this one, because Jefferson basically said, if your idea can't be taken out for a spin, right? If you can't take the idea you have out and be challenged, then it's not a good idea, right? So the point is your truth should be able to withstand someone else's truth, right? Like a conversation with
exactly.
them. So it's like not even about persuading Derek, right? It's like saying, I might say, wow, Derek thinks that. I'm not sure he's right, or I'm sure I disagree with him, but I'm not sure he's wrong. Does that make sense? It just means we're going to be in a different space, or we're looking at this a little bit differently. And it helps me challenge my own ideas.
Exactly. Well, as my wife always says, when the key to relationships and the key to politics, and she would advise me this before I'd give speeches at the Republican Party, she'd always say two words, get curious.
Yeah.
And I mean, what a great motto. She'd always say, get curious. And I think
not judgmental. That's Ted Lasso.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well said. And I think that's the moral of this story about pickleball
that's
is
right.
that it creates the kind of lasting deep relationships where if someone says something or does something you disagree with, rather than dehumanizing them or writing them off, you get curious
right.
and ask yourself, what am I missing?
Like, right.
What are they seeing that maybe I'm missing?
Right. Yeah. And I just think getting to know each other and building the relationship, right? And pickleball. I mean, I would say, by the way, all sports would do this. So I love the congressional softball, right? Like, I love all the things that they're doing. But just so cool to have, right, these members of the Senate putting it in a really convenient place, right? So they can make it easy and help to rebuild the relationships necessary to do the work.
And so hopefully they build the Pickleball Caucus.
That's
and
right.
It gets bigger and bigger with each passing year. All right. Thank you. This was a lot of fun at KSL at Night. This is Derek Brown with my good friend Leah Murray. Thanks for joining us and tune in tomorrow for more KSL at Night.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andrea Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.